Disc 2. By the day of the funeral, Hamilton had regained sufficient strength to attend with his brother. The two dazed, forlorn boys surely made a pathetic sight. In a little more than 2 years, they had suffered their father's disappearance and their mother's death, reducing them to orphans and throwing them upon the mercy of friends, family, and community. The town judge gave James Jr. money to buy shoes for the funeral and bought black veils for both boys. Their landlord, Thomas Dipnall, donated white bread, eggs, and cakes for the mourners, while cousin Peter Litton contributed 11 yards of black material to drape the coffin. As a divorced woman with two children conceived out of wedlock, Rachel was likely denied a burial at nearby St. John's Anglican Church. This may help to explain a mystifying ambivalence that Hamilton always felt about regular church attendance, despite a pronounced religious bent. The parish clerk officiated at a graveside ceremony at the Grange, the erstwhile Litton estate outside of Christiansted, where Rachel was laid to rest on a hillside beneath a grove of mahogany trees. There was to be no surcease from suffering for the two castaway boys, just a cascading series of crises. Heaps of bills poured in, including for the batch of medicine that had failed to save their mother. Less than a week after Rachel died, the probate officers again trooped to the house to appraise the estate. The moralistic tone of their report shows that Johann Michael Levian meditated further revenge against Rachel at the expense of her two illegitimate sons. The court decided that it had to consider three possible heirs. Peter Levian, whose father had divorced Rachel for valid reasons, according to information obtained by the court, by the highest authority, and the illegitimate James and Alexander, the obscene children born after the deceased person's divorce. The whole marital scandal was dredged up again, only now at an age when Alexander and his brother could fully fathom its meaning. At a probate hearing, Levian brandished the 1759 divorce decree and lambasted Alexander and James as children born in whoredom, insisting that Peter merited the entire estate, even though Peter hadn't set eyes on his mother for 18 years. Life had not improved for the embittered Levian, who had remained on a steep economic slide and served as janitor of a Frederiksted hospital. His second wife had died just a month before Rachel, and the couple had already lost the two children they had together. For a year after his mother's death, Alexander was held in painful suspense by the probate court, and perhaps absorbed the useful lesson that people who manipulate the law wield the real power in society. While he was awaiting settlement of the small estate, principally Rachel's slaves and a stock of business supplies, the court auctioned off her personal effects. James Litton considerately bought back for Alexander his trove of books. In light of Rachel's unhappy history with Levian, the final court decision seems foreordained. Alexander and James Hamilton were disinherited, and the whole estate was awarded to Peter Levian. In November 1769, no less implacably vengeful than his father, Peter Levian returned to St. Croix and took possession of his small inheritance, an injustice that rankled Alexander for many years. Peter had fared sufficiently well in Beaufort, South Carolina, to be named a church warden, the chief financial and administrative officer, in St. Helena's Parish the previous year, yet he couldn't spare a penny for the two destitute half-brothers orphaned by his mother's death. One sidelight of Peter Levian's return to St. Croix deserves attention because he did something shocking and seemingly inexplicable for a 23-year-old church warden. He was quietly baptized. Why had he not been baptized before? One explanation is that Johann Michael Levian had painstakingly concealed his Jewish roots, but still did not want his son baptized. Peter's furtive baptism, as if it were something shameful, suggests that he felt some extreme need for secrecy. After Rachel died, her sons were placed under the legal guardianship of their 32-year-old first cousin, Peter Litton. Already a widower, Peter had stumbled through a string of botched business dealings, including failed grocery stores in Christiansted. His brother later insisted that Peter was insane. Life as a ward of Peter Litton proved yet another merciless education in the tawdry side of life for Alexander Hamilton. Lytton had a black mistress, Ledya, who had given birth to a mulatto boy with the impressive name of Don Alvarez de Balesco. On July 16th, 1769, just when the Hamilton boys must have imagined that fate couldn't dole out more horrors, Peter Lytton was found dead in his bed, soaked in a pool of blood. According to court records, he had committed suicide and either stabbed or shot himself to death. For the Hamilton boys, the sequel was equally mortifying. Peter had drafted a will that provided for Ledya and their mulatto child, but didn't bother to acknowledge Alexander or James with even a token bequest. When a crestfallen James Lytton appeared to claim his son's estate, he tried to aid the orphan boys but was stymied by legal obstacles resulting from the suicide. On August 12, 1769, less than 1 month after Peter's death, the heartbroken James Lytton died as well. 5 days earlier, he had drafted a new will, which also made no provision for his nephews Alexander and James, who must have felt jinxed. Let us pause briefly to tally the grim catalog of disasters that had befallen these two boys between 1765 and 1769. Their father had vanished, their mother had died, their cousin and supposed protector had committed bloody suicide, and their aunt, uncle, and grandmother had all died. James, 16, and Alexander, 14, were now left alone, largely friendless and penniless. At every step in their rootless, topsy-turvy existence, they had been surrounded by failed, broken, embittered people. Their short lives had been shadowed by a stupefying sequence of bankruptcies, marital separations, deaths, scandals, and disinheritance. Such repeated shocks must have stripped Alexander Hamilton of any sense that life was fair, that he existed in a benign universe, or that he could ever count on help from anyone. That this abominable childhood produced such a strong, productive, self-reliant human being. That this fatherless adolescent could have ended up a founding father of a country he had not yet even seen seems little short of miraculous. Because he maintained perfect silence about his unspeakable past, never exploiting it to puff his later success, it was impossible for his contemporaries to comprehend the exceptional nature of his personal triumph. What we know of Hamilton's childhood has been almost entirely learned during the past century. Peter Lytton's death marked a fork in the road for Alexander and James, who henceforth branched off on separate paths. The latter was apprenticed to an aging Christiansted carpenter, Thomas McNobbany, which tells us much about his limited abilities. Most whites shied away from crafts such as carpentry, where they had to compete with mulattoes or even skilled slave labor. Had James shown any real promise or head for business, it is doubtful that he would have been relegated to manual work. By contrast, even before Peter Lytton's death, Alexander had begun to clerk for the mercantile house of Beekman and Kruger, the New York traders who had supplied his mother with provisions. It was the first of countless times in Hamilton's life when his superior intelligence was spotted and rewarded by older, more experienced men. Before considering his first commercial experience, we must ponder another startling enigma in Hamilton's boyhood. While James went off to train with the elderly carpenter, Hamilton, in a dreamlike transition worthy of a Dickens novel, was whisked off to the King Street home of Thomas Stevens, a well-respected merchant, and his wife Anne. Of the five Stevens children, Edward, born a year before Alexander, became his closest friend, an intimate acquaintance begun in early youth, as Hamilton described their relationship. As they matured, they often seemed to display parallel personalities. Both were exceedingly quick and clever, disciplined and persevering, fluent in French, versed in classical history, outraged by slavery, and mesmerized by medicine. In future years, Edward Stevens was wont to remind Hamilton of those vows of eternal friendship which we have so often mutually exchanged, and he often fretted about Hamilton's delicate health. If their personalities exhibited unusual compatibility, their physical resemblance bordered on the uncanny, often stopping people cold. 30 years later, when Hamilton's close friend Timothy Pickering, then Secretary of State, first set eyes on Edward Stevens, he was bowled over by the likeness. "At the first glance," recalled Pickering, "I was struck with the extraordinary similitude of his and General Hamilton's faces. I thought they must be brothers." When Pickering confided his amazement to Stevens's brother-in-law, James Yard of St. Croix, the latter informed me that the remark had been made 1,000 times. This mystery began to obsess the inquisitive Pickering, who finally concluded that Hamilton and Stevens were brothers. In notes assembled for a projected biography of Hamilton, Pickering wrote that it was generally understood that Hamilton was an illegitimate son of a gentleman of the name of Stevens. This scuttlebutt resonated through the 19th century, so that in 1882 Henry Cabot Lodge could write that every student of the period is familiar with the story, which oral tradition had handed down, that Hamilton was the illegitimate son of a rich West Indian planter or merchant, generally supposed to have been Mr. Stevens, the father of Hamilton's early friend and schoolfellow. What to make of this extraordinary speculation? No extant picture of Edward Stevens enables us to probe any family resemblance. Nevertheless, in the absence of direct proof, the notion that Alexander was the biological son of Thomas Stevens instead of James Hamilton would clarify many oddities in Hamilton's biography. It might identify one of the adulterous lovers who had so appalled Levian that he had hurled Rachel into prison. He would also explain why Thomas Stevens sheltered Hamilton right after Rachel's death, but made no comparable gesture to his brother James. In the 18th century, illegitimate children frequently masqueraded as orphaned relatives of the lord or lady of the house, a polite fiction understood and accepted by visitors. This parentage would also explain why Hamilton formed an infinitely more enduring bond with Edward Stevens than with his own brother. It might suggest why James Hamilton Sr. left his family behind, assumed no further responsibility for them, and took no evident delight in Alexander's later career. Most of all, it would account for the peculiar distance that later held Hamilton apart from both his father and brother. As will be seen, Alexander Hamilton was an intensely loyal person, endowed with a deep streak of family responsibility. There is something telltale about the way that he, his father, and his brother let relations abruptly lapse, as if the three of them were in headlong flight from some harrowing shared secret. Chapter 2. Hurricane. Even in the languorous tropics, Hamilton, while clerking at Beekman and Kruger, was schooled in a fast-paced modern world of trading ships and fluctuating markets. Whatever his frustrations, he did not operate in an obscure corner of the world, and his first job afforded him valuable insights into global commerce and the maneuvers of imperial powers. Working on an island first developed by a trading company, he was exposed early on to the mercantilist policies that governed European economies. Beekman and Kruger engaged in an export-import business that provided an excellent training ground for Hamilton, who had to monitor a bewildering inventory of goods. The firm dealt in every conceivable commodity required by planters: timber, bread, flour, rice, lard, pork, beef, fish, black-eyed peas, corn, porter, cider, pine, oak, hoops, shingles, iron, lime, rope, lampblack, bricks, mules, and cattle. Amid his various engagements in later years, John C. Hamilton said of his father, he adverted to this time as the most useful part of his education. He learned to write in a beautiful, clear, flowing hand. He had to mind money, chart courses for ships, keep track of freight, and compute prices in an exotic blend of currencies, including Portuguese coins, Spanish pieces of eight, British pounds, Danish ducats, and Dutch stivers. If Hamilton seemed very knowing about business as a young adult, it can partly be traced to these formative years. Located above the harbor at the elevated intersection of King and King's Cross Streets, Beekman and Kruger ran a shop and adjoining warehouse. A pleasant stroll down the sloping main street would have brought Hamilton, freshened by sea breezes, to the hectic wharf area where the firm maintained its own dock and ship. While the clerk inspected incoming merchandise, some of it contraband, the air was thick with the sweet fragrances of sugar, rum, and molasses, hauled in barrels by horse-drawn wagons and ready for shipment to North America in exchange for grain, flour, timber, and sundry other staples. The neutral Danish island served as a transit point to the French West Indies, converting Hamilton's ease in French into a critical business asset. As a rule, the merchants of St. Croix were natives of the British Isles, so that English, not Danish, functioned as the island's lingua franca. Beekman and Kruger furnished Hamilton with a direct link to his future home in New York, which carried on extensive trade with St. Croix. Many Manhattan trading firms dispatched young family members to the islands as local agents, and Nicholas Kruger was a prime example. He came from one of colonial New York's most distinguished families. His father, Henry, was a wealthy merchant, ship owner, and member of His Majesty's Royal Council for the province. His uncle, John Kruger, had been a long-standing mayor and a member of the Stamp Act Congress. While this blue-blooded clan had distinct Anglophile tendencies, time was to expose a split. Nicholas's brother, also Henry, based in Britain, was elected a member of Parliament from Bristol beside no less august a personage than Edmund Burke. Nicholas himself was to side with the rebel colonists and revere George Washington. One wonders whether he functioned as Hamilton's first political tutor. He also exposed Hamilton to a prosperous, civic-minded breed of New York businessmen who stood as models for the elite brand of federalism he later espoused. From the outset, the young Hamilton had phenomenal stamina for sustained work. Ambitious, orphaned boys do not enjoy the option of idleness. Even before starting work, he must have developed unusual autonomy for a 13-year-old, and Beekman and Kruger would only have toughened his moral fiber. Hamilton exuded an air of crisp efficiency and cool self-command. While his peers squandered their time on frivolities, Hamilton led a much more strenuous, urgent life that was to liberate him from St. Croix. He was a proud and sensitive boy, caught in the lower reaches of a rigid class society with small chance for social mobility. His friend Nathaniel Pendleton later said of his clerkship that Hamilton conceived so strong an aversion to it as to be induced to abandon altogether the pursuits of commerce. On November 11, 1769, in his earliest surviving letter, the 14-year-old Hamilton vented the blackest pent-up despair. Written in elegant penmanship, the letter shows that the young clerk felt demeaned by his lowly social station and chafed with excess energy. Already he sought psychic relief in extravagant fantasies of fame and faraway glory. The recipient was his dear friend and lookalike Edward Stevens, who had recently begun his studies at King's College in New York. "To confess my weakness, Ned, my ambition is so prevalent that I condemn the groveling and conditions of a clerk or the like to which my fortune, etc., condemns me, and would willingly risk my life, though not my character, to exalt my station. I'm confident, Ned, that my youth excludes me from any hopes of immediate preferment, nor do I desire it. But I mean to prepare the way for futurity. I'm no philosopher, you see, and may be justly said to build castles in the air. My folly makes me ashamed, and beg you'll conceal it. Yet, Neddy, we have seen such schemes successful when the projector is constant. I shall conclude by saying I wish there was a war. Alex Hamilton." What prophetic aspirations Hamilton telescoped into this short letter. The boy hankering for heroism and martial glory was to find his war soon enough. He betrayed a stinging sense of shame that the adult Hamilton would studiously cloak behind an air of bravado. Of special interest are his intuitive fear that his outsized ambition might corrupt him and his insistence that he would never endanger his ethics to conquer the world. Despite some awkwardness in the writing, he appears surprisingly mature for 14 and springs full-blown into the historical record. He had ample opportunities to exercise his many talents. In 1769, David Beekman quit the business and was replaced by Cornelius Courtright, another New Yorker with another prestigious name, and the firm was reconstituted as Courtright and Kruger. In October 1771, for medical reasons, Nicholas Kruger returned to New York for a five-month stint and left his precocious clerk in charge. A sheaf of revealing business letters drafted by Hamilton show him for the first time in the take-charge mode that was to characterize his tumultuous career. With peculiar zeal, he collected money owed to the firm. "Believe me, sir," he assured the absent Kruger, "I done as hard as is proper." The bulk of the correspondence concerns a sloop called the Thunderbolt, partly owned by the Krugers, that carried several dozen miserable mules through churning seas in early 1772. Hamilton had to direct this cargo safely along the Spanish Main, South America's northwestern coast, then brimming with hostile vessels. Hamilton did not hesitate to advise his bosses that they should arm the ship with 4 guns. He said flatly to Teilman Kruger, who oversaw family operations in Curaçao, it would be undoubtedly a great pity that such a vessel should be lost for the want of them. When the ship docked with 41 skeletal, drooping mules, Hamilton lectured the vessel's skipper in a peremptory tone that someday would be familiar to legions of respectful subordinates. Reflect continually on the unfortunate voyage you have just made, and endeavor to make up for the considerable loss therefrom accruing to your owners. The adolescent clerk had a capacity for quick decisions and showed no qualms about giving a tongue-lashing to a veteran sea captain. So proficient and eager to lead was he that he must have been slightly deflated when Nicholas Kruger returned to St. Croix in March 1772. Hamilton's apprenticeship provided many benefits. He developed an intimate knowledge of traders and smugglers that later aided his establishment of the U.S. Coast Guard and Customs Service. He saw that business was often obstructed by scarce cash or credit and learned the value of a uniform currency in stimulating trade. Finally, he was forced to ponder the paradox that the West Indian islands, with all their fertile soil, traded at a disadvantage with the rest of the world because of their reliance on only the sugar crop, a conundrum to which he was to return in his celebrated report on manufactures. It may be that Hamilton's preference for a diversified economy of manufacturing and agriculture originated in his youthful reflections on the avoidable poverty he had witnessed in the Caribbean. While Courtright and Kruger mostly brokered foodstuffs and dry goods, at least once a year the firm handled a large shipment of far more perishable cargo, slaves. On the slave ships, hundreds of Africans were chained and stuffed in fetid holds, where many suffocated. So vile were the conditions on these noisome ships that people on shore could smell their foul effluvia even miles away. On January 23, 1771, during Hamilton's tenure, his firm ran a notice atop the front page of the local bilingual paper, the Royal Danish American Gazette. Just imported from the windward coast of Africa and to be sold on Monday next by Messrs. Courtright and Kruger, at said Kruger's yard, 300 prime slaves. The following year, Nicholas Kruger imported 250 more slaves from Africa's Gold Coast and complained that they were very indifferent indeed, sickly and thin. One can only imagine the inhuman scenes that Hamilton observed as he helped to inspect, house, groom, and price the slaves about to be auctioned. To enhance their appearance, their bodies were shaved and rubbed with palm oil until their muscles glistened in the sunlight. Some buyers came armed with branding irons to imprint their initials on their newly purchased property. From the frequency with which Nicholas Kruger placed newspaper notices to catch runaway slaves, it seems clear that the traffic in human beings formed a substantial portion of his business. By the time Hamilton arrived on St. Croix, the burgeoning slave population had doubled in just a decade, and the planters banded together to guard against uprisings or mass escapes to nearby Puerto Rico, where slaves could secure their freedom under Spanish rule. In this fearful environment, no white enjoyed the luxury of being a neutral spectator. Either he was an accomplice of the slave system, or he left the island. To remove any ambiguity in the matter, the government in Copenhagen issued a booklet, the St. Croixian Pocket Companion, which spelled out the duties of every white on the island, duties that would have applied to Hamilton starting in 1771. Every male over 16 was obligated to serve in the militia and attend monthly drills with his arms and ammunition at the ready. If the fort fired its guns twice in a row, all white males had to grab their muskets and flock there instantly. On days when renegade slaves were executed at Christiansvern, the white men formed a ring around the fort to prevent other slaves from interfering. Any slave who attacked a white person faced certain death by hanging or decapitation, death that probably came as a blessed relief after first being prodded with red-hot pokers and castrated. Punishments were designed to be hellish so as to terrorize the rest of the captive population into submission. If a slave lifted a hand in resistance, it would be promptly chopped off. Any runaway who returned within a 3-month period would have 1 foot lopped off. If he then ran away a second time, the other foot was amputated. Recidivists might also have their necks fitted with grisly iron collars of sharp, inward-pointing spikes that made it impossible to crawl away through the dense underbrush without slashing their own throats in the effort. It is hard to grasp Hamilton's later politics without contemplating the raw cruelty that he witnessed as a boy and that later deprived him of the hopefulness so contagious in the American milieu. On the most obvious level, the slave trade of St. Croix generated a permanent detestation of the system and resulted in his later abolitionist efforts. But something deeper may have seeped into his consciousness. In this hierarchical world, skittish planters lived in constant dread of slave revolts and fortified their garrison state to avert them. Even when he left for America, Hamilton carried a heavy dread of anarchy and disorder that always struggled with his no less active love of liberty. Perhaps the true legacy of his boyhood was an equivocal one. He came to detest the tyranny embodied by the planters and their authoritarian rule, while also fearing the potential uprisings of the disaffected slaves. The twin specters of despotism and anarchy were to haunt him for the rest of his life. Like Ben Franklin, Hamilton was mostly self-taught and probably snatched every spare moment to read. The young clerk aimed to be a man of letters. He may already have had a premonition that his facility with words would someday free him from his humble birth and place him on a par with the most powerful men of his age. The West Indies boasted few stores that sold books, which had to be ordered by special subscription. For that reason, it must have been a godsend to the culture-starved Hamilton when the Royal Danish American Gazette launched publication in 1770. The paper had a pronounced Anglophile slant, reflecting the fact that King Christian VII of Denmark was both first cousin and brother-in-law to King George III of England. Each issue carried reverential excerpts from parliamentary debates in London, showcasing William Pitt the Elder and other distinguished orators, and retailed gossipy, fawning snippets about the royal household. Having a potential place to publish, Hamilton began to scribble poetry. Once his verbal fountain began to flow, it became a geyser that never ceased. The refined wit and pithy maxims of Alexander Pope mesmerized the young clerk, and just as Pope wrote youthful imitations of the classical poets, so Hamilton penned imitations of Pope. On April 6, 1771, he published a pair of poems in the Gazette that he introduced with a diffident note to the editor. "Sir, I am a youth about 17, and consequently such an attempt as this must be presumptuous. But if upon perusal you think the following piece worthy of a place in your paper, by inserting it you'll much oblige your obedient servant, A.H." The two amorous poems that follow are schizophrenic in their contrasting visions of love. In the first, the dreamy poet steals upon his virgin love, who is reclining by a brook as lambkins gambol around her. He kneels and awakens her with an ecstatic kiss before sweeping her up in his arms and carrying her off to marital bliss, intoning, "Believe me, love is doubly sweet in wedlock's holy bands." In the next poem, Hamilton has suddenly metamorphosed into a jaded rake who begins with a shocking, Swiftian opening line, "Celia's an artful little slut." This launches a portrait of a manipulative feline woman that concludes, "So, stroking puss's velvet paws, how well the jade conceals her claws, and purrs. But if at last you hap to squeeze her somewhat hard, she spits her back up, prenez garde. Good faith, she has you fast." The first poem seems to have been composed by a sheltered adolescent with an idealized view of women, and the second by a world-weary young philanderer who has already tasted many amorous sweets and shed any illusions about female virtue. In fact, this apparent attraction to two opposite types of women, the pure and angelic versus the earthy and flirtatious, ran straight through Hamilton's life, a contradiction he never resolved and that was to lead to scandalous consequences. The next year, Hamilton published two more poems in the paper, now recreating himself as a somber religious poet. The change in heart can almost certainly be attributed to the advent in St. Croix of a Presbyterian minister named Hugh Knox. Born in Northern Ireland of Scottish ancestry, the handsome young Knox migrated to America and became a schoolteacher in Delaware. As a raffish young man, he exhibited a lukewarm piety until a strange incident transformed his life. One Saturday at a local tavern where he was a regular, Knox amused his tipsy companions with a mocking imitation of a sermon delivered by his patron, the Reverend John Rogers. Afterward, Knox sat down, shaken by his own impiety, but also moved by the sermon that still reverberated in his mind. He decided to study divinity at the College of New Jersey, later Princeton, under its president, Aaron Burr, an eminent divine and father of the man who became Hamilton's nemesis. It was almost certainly from Knox's lips that Alexander Hamilton first heard the name of Aaron Burr. Ordained by Burr in 1755, Knox decided to propagate the gospel and was sent to Saba in the Dutch West Indies. This tiny island near Nevis measured 5 square miles, had no beaches, and was solitary enough to try the fortitude of the most determined missionary. Rough seas girded Saba's rocky shores, making it hazardous for ships to land there. As the sole clergyman, Knox resided in a settlement known as the Bottom, sunk in the elevated crater of an extinct volcano. It could be reached only by climbing up a stony path. Knox left a bleak picture of the heedless sinners he was assigned to save. Young fellows and married men, not only without any symptoms of serious religion, but keepers of Negro wenches, rakes, night rioters, drunkards, gamesters, Sabbath breakers, church neglectors, common swearers, unjust dealers, etc. An erudite man with a classical education, Knox was starved for both intellectual companionship and money. In 1771, he visited St. Croix and was received warmly by the local Presbyterians, who enticed him to move there. In May 1772, he became pastor at the Scotch Presbyterian Church at a salary considerably beyond what he had earned inside his old crater. After the lonely years in Saba, the 45-year-old Knox felt rejuvenated in St. Croix. Humane and tolerant, politically liberal, he was to fervently support American independence, opposed to slavery, though he owned some slaves, and later author of several volumes of sermons, he held a number of views that would have attracted Hamilton. In his earliest surviving letter, he defended his confirmed belief that illegitimate children should be baptized and argued that clergymen should rescue them from their parents instead of rejecting them. He departed from a strict Calvinist belief in predestination. Instead of a darkly punitive God, Knox favored a sunny, fair-minded one. He also saw human nature as insatiably curious and reserved his highest praise for minds that created schemes or systems of truth. Then an illegitimate young clerk with an uncommon knack for systematic thinking stepped into his life. Knox must have marveled at his tremendous luck in discovering Hamilton. We do not know exactly how they met, but Knox threw open his library to this prodigious youth, encouraged him to write verse, and prodded him toward scholarship. An avuncular man with a droll wit, Knox worried that Hamilton was too driven and prone to overwork, too eager to compensate for lost time, a failing, if it was one, that he never outgrew. In later years, Knox liked to remind Hamilton that he had been rather delicate and frail, with an ambition to excel, and had tended to strain every nerve to be the very best at what he was doing. Knox had an accurate intuition that this exceptional adolescent was fated to accomplish great deeds, although he later confessed that Alexander Hamilton had outstripped even his loftiest expectations. Among his other gifts, the versatile Hugh Knox was a self-taught doctor and apothecary, and a part-time journalist who occasionally filled in for the editor of the Royal Danish American Gazette. It may have been at the newspaper office, not at the church, that he first ran into Hamilton. That Knox moonlighted as a journalist proved highly consequential for Hamilton when a massive hurricane tore through St. Croix on the night of August 31st, 1772, and carved a wide swath of destruction through nearby islands. By all accounts, the storm struck with unprecedented fury, the Gazette reporting that it was the most dreadful hurricane known in the memory of man. Starting at sundown, the gales blew like great guns for about 6 hours, save for half an hour's intermission. The face of this once beautiful island is now so calamitous and disfigured as it would beggar all description. The tremendous winds uprooted tall trees, smashed homes to splinters, and swept up boats in foaming billows and flung them far inland. detailed reports of the storm in Nevis, where the destruction was comparable. Huge sugar barrels were tossed 400 yards. Furniture landed 2 miles away. Confirm its terrifying power. Nevis had also been struck by a severe earthquake that afternoon, and it seems probable that Nevis, St. Kitts, St. Croix, and neighboring islands were deluged by a tidal wave up to 15 feet high. The devastation was so widespread that an appeal for food was launched in the North American colonies to avert an anticipated famine. On September 6th, Hugh Knox gathered the jittery faithful at his church and delivered a consoling sermon that was published in pamphlet form some weeks later. Hamilton must have attended and been inspired by Knox's homily, for he went home and composed a long, feverish letter to his father, trying to convey the hurricane's horror. It is noteworthy that Hamilton was still in touch with his father more than 6 years after the latter's departure from St. Croix. That James Hamilton resided outside the storm area suggests that he was in the southern Caribbean, possibly Grenada or Tobago. In his melodramatic description of the hurricane, one sees the young Hamilton glorying in his verbal powers. He must have shown the letter to Knox, who persuaded him to publish it in the Royal Danish American Gazette, where it appeared on October 3rd. The prefatory note to the piece, presumably written by Knox, explained, "The following letter was written the week after the late hurricane by a youth of this island to his father. The copy of it fell by accident into the hands of a gentleman, who, being pleased with it himself, showed it to others to whom it gave equal satisfaction, and who all agreed that it might not prove unentertaining to the public." Lest anyone suspect that an unfeeling Hamilton was capitalizing on mass misfortune, Knox noted that the anonymous author had at first declined to publish it, perhaps the last time in Alexander Hamilton's life that he would prove bashful or hesitant about publication. Hamilton's famous letter about the storm astounds the reader for two reasons. For all its bombastic excesses, it does seem wondrous that a 17-year-old, self-educated clerk could write with such verve and gusto. Clearly, Hamilton was highly literate and already had a considerable fund of verbal riches. It seemed as if a total dissolution of nature was taking place. The roaring of the sea and wind, fiery meteors flying about it in the air, the prodigious glare of almost perpetual lightning, the crash of the falling houses, and the ear-piercing shrieks of the distressed were sufficient to strike astonishment into angels. But the description was also notable for the way Hamilton viewed the hurricane as a divine rebuke to human vanity and pomposity. In what sounded like a cross between a tragic soliloquy and a fire and brimstone sermon, he exhorted his fellow mortals, "Where now, O vile worm, is all thy boasted fortitude and resolution? What is become of thine arrogance and self-sufficiency? Death comes rushing on in triumph, veiled in a mantle of tenfold darkness, his unrelenting scythe pointed and ready for the stroke. See thy wretched, helpless state and learn to know thyself. Despise thyself and adore thy God. O ye who revel in affluence, see the afflictions of humanity and bestow your superfluity to ease them. Succor the miserable and lay up a treasure in heaven." Gloomy thoughts for a teenage boy, even in the aftermath of a lethal hurricane. The dark spirit of the storm that he summons up, his apocalyptic sense of universal tumult and disorder, bespeak a somber view of the cosmos. He also shows a strain of youthful idealism as he admonishes the rich to share their wealth. Hamilton did not know it, but he had just written his way out of poverty. This natural calamity was to prove his salvation. His hurricane letter generated such a sensation, even the island's governor inquired after the young author's identity, that a subscription fund was taken up by local businessmen to send this promising youth to North America to be educated. This generosity was all the more remarkable given the island's dismal state. The hurricane had flattened dwellings, shredded sugarcane, destroyed refineries, and threatened St. Croix with prolonged economic hardship. It would take many months, maybe years, for the island to recover. The chief sponsor of the subscription fund was likely the good-hearted Hugh Knox, who later told Hamilton, "I have always had a just and secret pride in having advised you to go to America and in having recommended you to some of my old friends there." The chief donors were probably Hamilton's past and present bosses, Nicholas Kruger, Cornelius Courtright, and David Beekman, plus his guardian, Thomas Stevens, and his first cousin, Anne Lytton Venton. Possibly aware of Hamilton's early, indeed abiding, interest in medicine, the business community may have hoped to train a doctor who would return and treat the many tropical diseases endemic to the island. Doctors were perpetually scarce in the Caribbean, and Edward Stevens was already in New York preparing for such a career. In the standard telling of his life, Hamilton boards a ship in October 1772 and sails off to North America forever. Yet a close study of the Royal Danish American Gazette and other documents raises questions about this usual chronology. Hamilton may have been the Juvenis who published a poem, The Melancholy Hour, in the Gazette of October 11, 1772. This brooding work, "Why hangs this gloomy damp upon my mind? Why heaves my bosom with the struggling sigh?" reprises the theme of the hurricane as heavenly retribution upon a fallen world. On October 17th, the Gazette ran an unsigned hymn in imitation of Pope that incontestably came from Hamilton's pen and was later cherished by his wife as proof of her husband's religious devotion. Entitled The Soul Ascending into Bliss, it is a lovely, mystical meditation in which Hamilton envisions his soul soaring heavenward. "Hark, hark, a voice from yonder sky, methinks I hear my Savior cry. I come, O Lord, I mount, I fly, on rapid wings I cleave the sky." There is a third poem by Hamilton that has been overlooked and that appeared in the Gazette of February 3, 1773, under the heading Christiansted, a Character by A.H. In this short, disillusioned verse, Hamilton evokes a sharp-witted fellow named Eugenio who manages inadvertently to antagonize all of his friends. The poem concludes, "Wit not well-governed rankles into vice. He to his jest his friend will sacrifice." The discovery of this poem, possibly influenced by an event in the life of Molière, bolsters the supposition that Hamilton spent the winter of 1772 to 1773 in St. Croix, although he could have mailed Hugh Knox the verse from North America. To understand this transitional moment in Hamilton's life, we must introduce yet another figure into the convoluted saga of his early years, his first cousin, Anne Lytton Venton, later Anne Mitchell. So incalculable was Hamilton's debt to her that on the eve of his duel with Burr, as he contemplated his life, he instructed his wife, "Mrs. Mitchell is the person in the world to whom, as a friend, I am under the greatest obligations. I have not hitherto done my duty to her." Why this guilt-ridden homage to a figure who has lingered in the historical shadows? 12 years older than Hamilton, Anne Lytton Venton was the oldest daughter of Rachel's sister Anne. Like so many figures in Hamilton's family, her life was a checkered one. In her early teens, she married a poor Christiansted grocer, Thomas Hallwood, and promptly had a son. After 1 year of marriage, Hallwood died. In 1759, Anne married the somewhat more prosperous John Kirwan Venton, who bought a small sugar estate. By 1762, his business had failed, and their home and effects were seized by creditors. The couple decamped to New York, leaving an infant daughter with Anne's parents. The Ventons evidently faltered in New York and were drawn back to St. Croix in 1770 after the suicide of Anne's brother Peter and the death of her father, James Lytton. If John Kirwan Venton hoped to lay hands on Anne's inheritance, he was foiled by the foresight of his father-in-law, who left 2/7 of his estate to Anne, but specifically excluded Venton from the money, calling him unfortunate in his conduct. At this point, the Venton marriage dissolved in acrimony, with Anne and her daughter occupying Peter's house in Christiansted while John took refuge in Frederickstead. After the hurricane, John Venton filed for bankruptcy again and posted a notice to his creditors. No less mean-spirited than Johann Michael Levien, Venton also placed the following threatening ad in the Gazette of May 15, 1773. "John Kirwan Venton forbids all masters of vessels from carrying Anne Venton or her daughter Anne Lytton Venton off this island." Defying this warning, Anne Venton and her daughter fled to New York, a brave act that would have reminded Hamilton of his mother flouting the odious Levien. To secure her inheritance, Anne entrusted the 18-year-old Hamilton with a power of attorney that allowed him to collect payments from her father's estate due on May 3rd and 26th and June 3rd, 1773. It may well have been after receipt of this money that he boarded a vessel bound for Boston, leaving the West Indies forever. Perhaps in gratitude for his assistance, or else plain affection for her exceedingly bright cousin, Anne Lytton Venton repaid Hamilton by becoming a benefactor, quite likely the principal benefactor, of his voyage to North America and subsequent education. If so, Hamilton repaid the favor by aiding Anne financially in future years. He always felt under a more compelling obligation to her than to anyone else from his early years, and we may know only a fraction of the vital services that she rendered him. What a world of scarred emotion and secret grief Alexander Hamilton bore with him on the boat to Boston. He took his unhappy boyhood, tucked it away in a mental closet, and never opened the door again. Beside the horrid memories, this young dynamo simply was not cut out for the drowsy, slow-paced life of slave owners on a tropical island, and he never evinced the least nostalgia for his West Indian boyhood or voiced any desire to return. He wrote 2 years later, "Men are generally too much attached to their native countries to leave it and dissolve all their connections, unless they are driven to it by necessity." He chose a psychological strategy adopted by many orphans and immigrants. He decided to cut himself off from his past and forge a new identity. He would find a home where he would be accepted for what he did, not for who he was, and where he would no longer labor in the shadow of illegitimacy. His relentless drive, his wretched feelings of shame and degradation, and his precocious self-sufficiency combined to produce a young man with an insatiable craving for success. As a student of history, he knew the mutability of human fortune and later observed, "The changes in the human condition are uncertain and frequent. Many on whom fortune has bestowed her favors may trace their family to a more unprosperous station, and many who are now in obscurity may look back upon the affluence and exalted rank of their ancestors." He would be the former, his father no less unmistakably the latter. As Alexander sailed north toward spectacular adventures, his father sank ever deeper into incurable poverty. Documents located in St. Vincent reveal that James Hamilton had wandered to the southern end of the Caribbean, almost the coast of South America. On the tiny, secluded island of Bekwe, located just south of St. Vincent, he had entered into a program set up by the British Crown to encourage impoverished settlers. Bekwe is the northernmost of the Grenadine Islands, an isolated spot, 7 square miles in size, of short hills, jagged cliffs, and sandy beaches. On March 14, 1774, James Hamilton signed a contract that gave him 25 acres of free woodland property along the shore of Southeast Bay. In this lovely but menacing place, a stronghold of indigenous black and yellow Caribs and runaway slaves, James Hamilton chose a spot on public land reserved for a future fortification. Bekwe was the sort of distant, godforsaken place that could have attracted only somebody who had exhausted all other options. The deed for James Hamilton's land purchase tells its own tacit tale of woe. It made clear that his 25 acres were not adapted for sugar plantations and had been set aside for the accommodations of poor settlers. Under the grant, James Hamilton didn't have to pay a penny for the first 4 years, but had to stay on the island for at least 1 year. A 1776 survey shows him sharing 70 acres with a man named Simple, and they are the only two people listed on the roster of poor residents. There must have been days when it was hard for Hamilton to believe that he was the fourth son of a Scottish laird and had grown up in a fog-bound castle. The descent of his life had been as stunning and irrevocable as the rise of his son in America was to seem almost blessedly inevitable. Chapter 3. The Collegian. Alexander Hamilton never needed to worry about leading a tedious, uneventful life. Drama shadowed his footsteps. When his ship caught fire during his 3-week voyage to North America, crew members scrambled down ropes to the sea and scooped up seawater in buckets, extinguishing the blaze with some difficulty. The charred vessel managed to sail into Boston Harbor intact, and Hamilton proceeded straight to New York. This was a mandatory stop, since he had to pick up his allowance at Courtright and Company, which managed the subscription fund that financed his education. The New York firm owned 7 vessels that shuttled between New York and the West Indies and employed Courtright and Kruger as its St. Croix representative. Periodically, the subscription fund was replenished by sugar barrels sent from St. Croix, with Hamilton pocketing a percentage of the proceeds from each shipment. Hence, the education of this future abolitionist was partly underwritten by sugarcane harvested by slaves. When he came to New York, Hamilton was fortified with introductory letters from Hugh Knox, but otherwise did not know a soul except Edward Stevens. Yet this young man from the tropics, who had probably never worn an overcoat or experienced a change of seasons, did not seem handicapped by his past and never struck people as a provincial bumpkin. He seemed to vault over the high hurdles of social status with ease. Smart, handsome, and outgoing, he marched with an erect military carriage, thrusting out his chest in an assertive manner. He had all the magnetic power of a mysterious foreigner and soon made his first friend, a fashionable tailor with the splendid name of Hercules Mulligan, whose brother was a junior partner at Courtright & Company. Born in Ireland in 1740, the colorful, garrulous Mulligan was one of the few tradesmen Hamilton ever befriended. He had a shop and home on Water Street, and Hamilton may have boarded with him briefly. With a sizable dollop of Irish blarney, Mulligan took full credit for introducing Hamilton into New York society. "Mr. H. used in the evenings to sit with my family and my brother's family and write doggerel rhymes for their amusement. He was always amiable and cheerful and extremely attentive to his books." These soirees may have featured some subversive political content, for Hercules Mulligan had reputedly been one of the Liberty Boys involved in a skirmish with British soldiers on Golden Hill, John Street, 6 weeks before frightened British troops gunned down fractious colonists in the 1770 Boston Massacre. Later, during the British occupation of wartime New York, Mulligan was to dabble in freelance espionage for George Washington, discreetly pumping his foppish clients, mostly Tories and British officers, for strategic information as he taped their measurements. Hamilton's early itinerary in America closely mirrored the connections of Hugh Knox. Through Knox, he came to know 2 of New York's most eminent Presbyterian clergymen. Knox's old mentor, Dr. John Rogers, an imposing figure who strutted grandly down Wall Street en route to church, grasping a gold-headed cane and nodding to well-wishers, and the Reverend John Mason, whose son would end up attempting an authorized biography of Hamilton. Through another batch of Knox's introductory letters, Hamilton ended up studying at a well-regarded preparatory school across the Hudson River, the Elizabethtown Academy. Like all autodidacts, Hamilton had some glaring deficiencies to correct and required cram courses in Latin, Greek, and advanced math to qualify for college. Elizabethtown, New Jersey, today Plain Elizabeth, was chartered by George II and ranked as the colony's oldest English community. It was a small, idyllic village graced with orchards, 2 churches, a stone bridge arching over the Elizabeth River, and windmills dispersed among the salt meadows outside of town. Located on the grounds of the Presbyterian Church, the Elizabethtown Academy occupied a 2-story building topped by a cupola. Its headmaster, Francis Barber, was a recent graduate of the College of New Jersey, henceforth called Princeton, its much later name, and was only 5 years older than Hamilton. He was a dashing figure, with a high forehead, heavy eyebrows, and a small, prim mouth. Steeped in the classics and with reform-minded political sympathies, he was in many ways an ideal preceptor for Hamilton. He would see combat duty on the patriotic side during the Revolution and would find himself at Yorktown in a startling inversion under the direct command of his West Indian pupil. Because the Elizabethtown Academy supplied many students to Princeton, we can deduce something about Hamilton's preparatory studies from that college's requirements. Princeton applicants had to know Virgil, Cicero's orations, and Latin grammar, and also had to be so well acquainted with the Greek as to render any part of the 4 evangelists in that language into Latin or English. Never tentative about tackling new things and buoyed by a preternatural self-confidence, Hamilton proved a fantastically quick study. He often worked past midnight, curled up in his blanket, then awoke at dawn and paced the nearby burial ground, mumbling to himself as he memorized his lessons. Hamilton's lifelong habit of talking sotto voce while pacing lent him an air of either inspiration or madness. A copious note-taker, he left behind in a minute hand an exercise book in which he jotted down passages from the Iliad in Greek, took extensive notes on geography and history, and compiled detailed chapter synopses from the books of Genesis and Revelation. As if wanting to pack every spare moment with achievement, he also found time to craft poetry and wrote the prologue and epilogue of an unspecified play performed by a local detachment of British soldiers. Hamilton's attendance at the Elizabethtown Academy brought him into the immediate vicinity of the younger Aaron Burr, who had attended the same school several years earlier. Burr's brother-in-law, jurist Tapping Reeve, sat on the Academy's Board of Visitors and had been a vital force behind the school's creation. By an extraordinary coincidence, Burr spent the summer of 1773 in Elizabethtown, right around the time Hamilton arrived. Hamilton might have seen this handsome, genial young man sauntering down the street, gliding by in a boat along the town's many inlets, or hunting in the nearby woods. As we shall see, they probably also met in the drawing rooms of mutual friends. Hamilton always displayed an unusual capacity for impressing older, influential men, and he gained his social footing in Elizabethtown with surpassing speed, crossing over an invisible divide into a privileged, patrician world in a way that would have been impossible in St. Croix. Thanks to the letters from Hugh Knox, he had instant access to men at the pinnacle of colonial society in New Jersey. He met William Livingston and Elias Boudinot, well-heeled lawyers and luminaries in the Presbyterian political world, who exposed him to the heterodox political currents of the day. They were both associated with the Whigs, who sought to curb royal power, boost parliamentary influence, and preserve civil liberties. Unquestionably, the most vivid figure in Hamilton's new life was 50-year-old Livingston, a born crusader, who had abandoned a contentious career in New York politics to assume the sedate life of a New Jersey country squire. As work proceeded on Liberty Hall, his 120-acre estate, Livingston took temporary quarters in town, and Hamilton may have lodged with him during this interlude. Livingston was the sort of contradictory figure that always enchanted the young Hamilton. A blue-blooded rebel and scion of a powerful Hudson River clan, Livingston had spurned an easy life to write romantic poetry, crank out polemical essays, and plunge into controversial causes. Tall and lanky, nicknamed the Whipping Post, the voluble Livingston tilted lances with royal authorities with such self-righteous glee that one Tory newspaper anointed him the Don Quixote of the Jerseys. Like many Presbyterians, Livingston had gravitated to political dissent while opposing Tory efforts to entrench the Church of England in America. 2 decades earlier, he had spearheaded a vitriolic campaign to block the establishment of an Anglican college in New York, which, he warned, would become a contracted receptacle of bigotry and an instrument of royal power. After their campaign failed and the school received a royal charter as King's College in 1754, Livingston and his friends founded the New York Society Library to provide safe alternative reading matter for students. Hamilton would take out books there. An opponent of the Stamp Act and subsequent measures to saddle the colonies with oppressive taxes, Livingston was to attend the Continental Congress and the Constitutional Convention and become the first governor of an independent New Jersey in 1776. A gregarious man, William Livingston conducted Hamilton into a much more glamorous society than the one he left behind. Though benefiting from Livingston largesse, Hamilton was never mistaken for the family help, and he befriended the Livingston children, including the cerebral Brockholst, who was later an eminent Supreme Court judge and already friendly with Aaron Burr. There were also dazzling Livingston daughters to ravish the eye. As one of Burr's friends observed of Elizabethtown at the time, there is certainly something amorous in its very air. Hamilton observed the courtship of the beautiful, high-spirited Sarah Livingston to a young lawyer named John Jay. So regal was Sarah Livingston's presence that when she later attended the opera in Paris, some audience members mistook her for the Queen of France. A special rapport sprang up between Hamilton and another Livingston daughter, Catherine, known as Kitty. She was the type of woman Hamilton found irresistible. Pretty, coquettish, somewhat spoiled, and always ready for flirtatious banter. Judging from a letter Hamilton wrote to her during the Revolution, one suspects that Kitty was his first romantic conquest in America. "I challenge you to meet me in whatever path you dare, and if you have no objection, for variety and amusement, we will even make excursions in the flowery walks and roseate bowers of Cupid. You know I am renowned for gallantry and shall always be able to entertain you with a choice collection of the prettiest things imaginable. You shall be one of the Graces, or Diana, or Venus, or something surpassing them all. It is hard to imagine that Alexander Hamilton slept under the same roof as Kitty Livingston and didn't harbor impure thoughts. In this sociable world, Hamilton also befriended Livingston's brother-in-law, William Alexander, a bluff convivial man known as Lord Stirling because of his contested claim to a Scottish earldom. An extravagant spendthrift, he was already swamped with debt when he met Hamilton. A decade earlier, the handsome, round-faced Stirling had constructed a 1,000-acre estate at Basking Ridge, adorned with stables, gardens, and a deer park in imitation of the country houses of British nobility. Like Livingston, Lord Stirling was a curious amalgam of reformer and self-styled aristocrat. He rode about in a coach emblazoned with a Stirling coat of arms and possessed a princely wardrobe of 31 coats, 58 vests, 43 pairs of breeches, 30 shirts, 27 cravats, and 14 pairs of shoes. If Aaron Burr is to be trusted, Lord Stirling drank his way straight through the American Revolution as a brigadier general, plied by his aide-de-camp, James Monroe, who served as his faithful cupbearer. Monroe's whole duty was to fill his lordship's tankard and hear, with indications of admiration, his lordship's long stories about himself. Burr's barbed commentary doesn't do justice to the bibulous Lord Stirling, who would win renown in the Battle of Brooklyn. He was a literate man with eclectic interests, including mathematics and astronomy. He published a monograph on the transit of Venus, and a co-founder of the New York Society Library. Of special relevance to Hamilton's future, he was a leading proponent of American manufactures. He bred horses and cattle, grew grapes and made wine, and produced pig iron and hemp. Lord Stirling had one final attraction for Hamilton. He also had enchanting daughters, especially the charming Catherine, always called Lady Kitty. She was to marry William Duer, the most notorious friend in Hamilton's life. The third and most enduring tie formed by Hamilton was with Elias Boudinot, a lawyer who later became president of the Continental Congress and who owned copper and sulfur mines. A balding man with a jowly face and a smile that radiated benign intelligence, Boudinot was an innkeeper's son and, like Hamilton, descended from French Huguenots. Such was his piety that he became the first president of the American Bible Society. As an organizer of the Elizabethtown Academy, he had pushed for the admission of a number of free scholars in this town and would have embraced heartily a poor but deserving youth such as Hamilton. As a regular visitor to Boudinot's mansion, Boxwood Hall, Hamilton was exposed to a refined world of books, political debate, and high culture. Boudinot's wife, Annie, wrote verse that George Washington complimented as elegant poetry, and this bookish family gathered each evening to hear biographies and sacred histories read aloud. Hamilton's friendship with the Boudinots was so intimate that when their infant daughter, Anna Maria, contracted a fatal illness in September 1774, Hamilton kept a vigil by the sickly child and composed an affecting elegy after she died. This poem highlights a notable capacity for empathy in Hamilton, who dared to write it in the voice of the grieving mother. Since Hamilton had at least one sibling who had died in infancy or childhood, the poem may have summoned up memories of his own mother's hardships. For the sweet babe, my doting heart, did all a mother's fondness feel, careful to act each tender part and guard from every threatening ill. But what, alas, availed my care? The unrelenting hand of death, regardless of a parent's prayer, has stopped my lovely infant's breath. Later on, friends would comment on the almost maternal solicitude that Hamilton showed for friends or family members in distress. As a young man in a constant rush, scarcely pausing for breath, Hamilton did not dally in Elizabethtown for more than 6 months. Nevertheless, this fleeting period may have left its imprint on his politics. He hobnobbed with wealthy, accomplished men who lived like English nobility, even as they agitated for change. These men wanted to modify the social order, not overturn it, a fair description of Hamilton's future politics. At this juncture, Hamilton's New Jersey patrons rejected national independence as a rash option, favored reconciliation, and repeatedly invoked their rights as English subjects. Far from wanting separation from the British Empire, they favored fuller integration into it. Britain remained their beau ideal, if a somewhat faded one. Hamilton later admitted to having had a strong prejudice for the British viewpoint while at Elizabethtown and apparently leaned toward monarchism. Like his mentors, he would always be an uneasy and reluctant revolutionary who found it hard to jettison legal forms in favor of outright rebellion. Mingling with Presbyterians may also have influenced his politics. The denomination was associated with the Whig critique of the British crown, while Anglicans tended to be Tories and more often supported British imperial policy toward the colonies and an established church. As Hamilton contemplated his next educational step, there were only 9 colleges in the colonies to consider. William Livingston and Elias Boudinot sat on Princeton's board of trustees. Livingston was such a trusted friend of the former president, Aaron Burr, that he had delivered his eulogy, and it would have been impolitic, not to say rude, for Hamilton to resist their entreaties to at least scout out the college. The school already had a contingent of West Indian students, and President John Witherspoon was so eager to augment their numbers, or tap the money of rich sugar planters for professorships, that he had issued a rousing newspaper appeal the previous year. An address to the inhabitants of Jamaica and the other West Indian islands on behalf of the College of New Jersey, wherein he discoursed on the advantages of his college for the education of West Indian youth. Founded in 1746 as a counterweight to the Church of England's influence, Princeton was a hotbed of Presbyterian Whig sentiment, preached religious freedom, and might have seemed a logical choice for Hamilton. Hercules Mulligan contends that Hamilton told him that he preferred Princeton to King's College because it was more Republican. Indeed, the school bubbled with such political ferment that it was denounced in Tory quarters as a nursery of political radicalism. President Witherspoon confessed that the spirit of liberty ran high and strong at Princeton. Little more than a coach stop between New York and Philadelphia, the rural hamlet of Princeton was hemmed in by thick forests. For Presbyterians eager to produce new ministers to fill rapidly expanding pulpits, this isolation was a protective measure that shielded students from urban temptations. The school stood in the throes of a religious revival when Hamilton applied. Hercules Mulligan said that he accompanied his young friend to this rustic outpost and introduced him to Witherspoon, but William Livingston and Elias Boudinot, as trustees, would have provided any needed introductions. An eminent theologian, born in Edinburgh, Witherspoon was a husky man with an oddly shaped head that narrowed at the top and bulged out in the middle. Gary Wills has called him probably the most influential teacher in the history of American education, and Princeton, under his tutelage, produced a bumper crop of politician alumni. A U.S. president, a vice president, 21 senators, 29 congressmen, and 12 state governors. He was to sign the Declaration of Independence and minister to the Continental Congress as its first clergyman. By no coincidence, Princeton outpaced all other colleges by sending 9 alumni to the Constitutional Convention. Witherspoon could be intimidating on first encounter. Pugnacious and outspoken, he had an unsettling way of erupting in strange twitches and fidgets. Hamilton, with his rock-hard ego, held his ground with a college president. Witherspoon examined Hamilton orally and was impressed by his fully-fledged intellect. Then Hamilton made an unconventional proposal. According to Hercules Mulligan, Hamilton informed Witherspoon that he wanted to enter the college and advance with as much rapidity as his exertions would enable him to do. Dr. Witherspoon listened with great attention to so unusual a proposition from so young a person and replied that he had not the sole power to determine that, but that he would submit the request to the trustees who would decide. One feels here the vastly accelerated tempo of Hamilton's life, which was likely due to the chronic impatience fostered by his belated start in life. When Witherspoon had taken over at Princeton a few years earlier, he had set about to stiffen its lax admissions requirements and might have frowned on Hamilton's special timetable for that reason. Mulligan blamed the trustees for rebuffing the proposal, saying that 2 weeks later Hamilton received a letter from Witherspoon stating that the request could not be complied with because it was contrary to the usage of the college and expressing his regret because he was convinced that the young gentleman would do honor to any seminary at which he should be educated. In fact, there had been a precedent for Hamilton's brash request. Aaron Burr had tried to enter Princeton at age 11 and was told he was too young. He had then crammed for 2 years and cheekily applied for admission to the junior class at age 13. In a compromise, he was admitted as a sophomore and graduated in 1772 at 16. Hamilton may have learned about this experience from Burr himself or through their mutual friend, Brockholst Livingston. In weighing Hamilton's demand, Witherspoon and his trustees may have been deterred by the recent experience of a young Virginia scholar who had entered as a sophomore in 1769 and worked himself into a state of nervous exhaustion by completing his bachelor's degree in 2 years instead of three. His name was James Madison, later Hamilton's illustrious collaborator on the Federalist Papers. Fond of Witherspoon and too weak to travel after graduation, Madison had lingered in Princeton for a year to study privately with the old doctor. When Madison finally returned to Virginia in the spring of 1772, he was still so debilitated from his intense studies that he feared for his health. While applying to Princeton, Hamilton may have decided to correct his real age and shed a couple of years. If he was born in 1755, he would have been applying to college at 18, when 14 or 15 was often the standard minimum age for entrance, a highly uncomfortable state of affairs for a wunderkind. Gouverneur Morris had entered King's College at age 12. Prodigies aren't supposed to be overaged freshmen. To be sure, Madison had entered Princeton at 18, but he was considered slightly old for a newcomer and skipped to sophomore status. If Hamilton trimmed 2 years from his age, one can sympathize with him. After all, while Aaron Burr was delivering a commencement speech at Princeton the year before, Hamilton, a year older, was still trying to figure out an escape route from Kruger's counting house on St. Croix. For a precocious young man in his predicament, lying about his age would have been a pardonable lapse. Spurned at Princeton, Hamilton ended up at King's College. He did not lack sponsors. Lord Stirling, who had inherited a townhouse on Broad Street in Lower Manhattan, had long sat on the college's governing board and raised money for it. Hamilton's life was now set moving in a new direction. This nomadic, stateless boy found a home in the best possible city for a future Treasury secretary, a city in which commerce always held an honored place. He was to be immersed in a heady world of business, law, and politics, and he made valuable contacts in the merchant community. Had he gone to Princeton, Hamilton might well have been radicalized sooner in the revolt against Britain, but that is arguable. Instead of with Witherspoon, Hamilton studied under one of the most ardent Tories in the colonies, Dr. Miles Cooper, the president of King's. Attendance at King's placed Hamilton in a city with a vocal Tory population, the bastion of British colonial power. At the same time, being in New York was also to lead to first-hand contact with tremendous revolutionary ferment and exposure to some of the colony's most eloquent agitators and outspoken newspapers. The virulent clash of Tories and Whigs in New York was to sharpen all of the conflicting feelings in Hamilton's nature, enabling him to sympathize with the views of both patriots and loyalists. In fact, by rejecting Alexander Hamilton, President Witherspoon and his associates at Princeton unintentionally thrust the young West Indian straight into the thick of the combustible patriotic drama in a way that would have proved impossible in a sleepy New Jersey country town. Set on an enormous tract of land that Trinity Church had received from Queen Anne early in the century, King's College stood on the northern fringe of the city, housed in a stately three-story building with a cupola that commanded a superb view of the Hudson River across a low, rambling meadow. This elevated campus is defined by today's West Broadway, Murray, Barclay, and Church Streets, a spot that one British visitor rhapsodized as the most beautiful site for a college in the world. President Cooper tried gamely to segregate his students from unwholesome external influences. "The edifice is surrounded by a high fence," he wrote, "which also encloses a large court and garden, and a porter constantly attends at the front gate, which is closed at 10 o'clock each evening in the summer and at 9 in the winter, after which hours the names of all that come in are delivered weekly to the president." This cloistered environment was modeled upon Oxford's, and the students strode about in academic caps and gowns. One reason that Cooper sought to sequester his students was that the college adjoined the infamous red light district known as the Holy Ground, its name a satirical allusion to the fact that St. Paul's Chapel owned the land. As many as 500 Dutch and English ladies of pleasure, equivalent to 2% of the city's entire population, patrolled these dusky lanes each evening, and the proximity of this haunt to susceptible young scholars troubled town elders. One dismayed Scot visitor wrote in 1774, "One circumstance I think is a little unlucky is that the entrance to King's College is through one of the streets where the most noted prostitutes live." The college promulgated rules that none of the pupils shall frequent houses of ill fame or keep company with any persons of known scandalous behavior. Women were strictly banned from the college grounds, along with cards, dice, and other subtle snares of the devil. In returning to the college before the curfew, did Hamilton sometimes linger in the holy ground to sample its profane pleasures? In warding off outside temptations, President Cooper also looked askance at the political protests mounted nearby. End of Disc 2.